I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Parts of the landmark healthcare legislation kick in this week. Remember the provision that allows young adults to stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26? Also, insurers will no longer be able to deny children coverage based on pre-existing conditions or drop coverage after patients get sick. Democrats wrote the law so that those popular measures would take effect just before the midterm elections. But polls also show that while Americans are for the individual measures, about half are against the overall plan. Laura Meckler is with the Wall Street Journal. And Laura, we want to talk about the political ramifications of all this in just a minute. But first, tell us more about the parts of the bill that go into effect this week.
Well, Robin, there are a variety of provisions that take effect this week. People can stay on their parents' plans up until age 26. So if you graduate from college and you don't have a job or don't have a job that offers health insurance, you can be on your parents' health insurance plan. Secondly, insurance companies have to provide preventive services without charging a copayment. That only applies to plans that are sold on the open market, on the individual market. So if you get your insurance from your employer, that doesn't affect you.
And by preventive things, what, just tick off a couple that'll now you don't need a copay for?
You know, a mammogram, for instance, or any kind of a pap smear, any kind of a health care screening test of any sort, things that are meant to prevent something from happening down the line. That's one of the important provisions. There's no lifetime limits on benefit payouts. That affects a few people, but the people who it does affect, you know, it's very important to. It also phases out annual limits on benefit payments. So, for instance, health insurance rules that say we're only going to spend $1 million per year per person or some other amount of money, those limits are being phased out. And also importantly, insurers can no longer deny children coverage if they have a pre-existing condition. Eventually, the law will prohibit insurers from denying anybody coverage based on a pre-existing condition. But for right now, it affects children.
Well, you report that insurance companies are telling consumers through letters that they're sending home that these changes brought about by health care reform are going to increase their rates. Now, we understand the president is going to meet with state insurance commissioners to talk about this. What's going on here?
Well, insurers have to submit requests for rate increases to regulators on the state level. And in doing that, they have told them that they're going to be increasing rates by 9-10%, and they're attributing that to the health care reform law. The White House and the other Democrats who support this say that, no, those increases should really only be, you know, just 1 or 2 percentage points, that they're exaggerating the amount of money it's going to cost them to do these things. But this is sort of a genuine dispute that's going on. And as you mentioned, President Obama will be meeting with them at the White House on Wednesday, where he'll be sort of wagging his finger at them saying, you know, don't blame that.
Well, and the president is also going to give his health care speech on Wednesday, touting some of these benefits from the bill. But we also know 20 states have filed suits to prevent part of the laws from taking effect. Some Republicans are vowing to repeal it if they regain control of the House. I mentioned polls show, you know, half Americans don't like the idea of reform, while they do like these individual benefits. So what are Democrats going to do as far as campaigning on these benefits?
Democrats really have been shying away from the issue of health care in this election, except for those Democrats who voted against the health reform bill. Those Democrats are touting that as a sign of their independence from the party. Right now, the Democratic Party nationally is very unpopular, and the health care law, you know, fairly or unfairly, is part of that reason.
Well, and another reason that it might be unpopular is because of things people say about it. Christine O'Donnell, who's the Tea Party candidate from Delaware, is arriving a concept, if not the line that Sarah Palin used, this concept of death panels. O'Donnell spoke at that Value Voter Summit on Friday and said bureaucrats would decide who is just too old or it's too expensive to be worth saving. Are we likely to hear more of that kind of rhetoric? And again, there is no such thing as a death panel.
Right. That is very misleading what she said. Are we going to hear more of that? I don't think that that's really where the Republican argument, though, as a whole, is against health care. I think it's more along the lines of this is too expensive, we can't afford it, it's too much government intrusion into your lives, your rates are going to go up, those kinds of things, things that where there's more genuine political debate.
Well, and one last thought from you about these changes. People with large employers may not see some of these changes until January 1st because the law allows them to take effect for those large employers when the next plan year begins.
Right.
Okay. Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, Republicans have been trying to keep the focus on government spending, but candidate O'Donnell and a new book out this fall will put the spotlight back on the conservative Christian wing of the party. The book tells of the Fellowship, the secretive evangelical organization that's behind C Street House, which is sort of a dorm where male lawmakers, largely Republican but Democrat as well, get room, board, and spiritual fellowship. But at least two, Congressman Chip Pickering and Nevada Senator John Ensign, also apparently use the House as a cover for affairs. So suddenly, C Street and the Fellowship, or the Family, as the larger worldwide organization is known, are not so secret anymore. What's been revealed is a decades-long ministry that launched the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, but also conducts private foreign policy, often in countries with brutal dictators, using American lawmakers and giving the impression that the missions are U.S. government sanctioned. Jeff Charlotte's new book is C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. He's a Dartmouth professor and contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone. In a recent Harper's article, he writes about a Ugandan offshoot of the Fellowship, which was behind the recent proposed law to criminalize homosexuality in Uganda. And Jeff joins us to talk about all of this from the studios of NPR New York. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Good to be here.
And give us the thumbnail. What exactly is the Family or the Fellowship?
It's the oldest and arguably most influential Christian conservative group in Washington, and the way that it has endured since 1935, when it began as an anti-New Deal coalition, is by not engaging in the kind of Bible-thumping, pulpit-pounding tactics that we usually associate with the Christian right. It's a much softer sell evangelism. The original founder and the current leader, a man named Doug Coe, have both referred to it as a form of fundamentalism, but it's much more appealing, and it's also geared only to elites, the idea that if you can help the strong, then they'll pass the blessings down to the weak through a sort of trickle-down religion.
Well, as Peter Boyer writes in a piece that he's written on the group in The New Yorker, the core mission is interpersonal ministry to the powerful, meant to turn their hearts to the poor. It was founded by a Methodist preacher, a Norwegian immigrant, who also helped create Goodwill Industries in Seattle back in the early 1900s. He started the prayer breakfast with Ike Eisenhower in 1953.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of a very benign read. And if you rely for your account of the Family strictly on the founder, a guy named Abram Verrades, sort of hagiography this friend of his wrote, it sounds like a pretty great group. Although even there, he says, you know, we, right from the beginning, we were trying to break up the influence of unions in Seattle, where he began. He very quickly shifted to the right and during the 1930s, as many did. And by the end of World War II, he had declared World War III on communism. He would describe this as worldwide spiritual offensive. And in pursuit of that, he decided, well, what we need to do, as America did during the Cold War, is find the toughest, dirtiest guys around the world, men like Papadoc Duvalier, Suharto in Indonesia, Ferdinand Marcos, and prop them up and help them stay in power. Except what Verrady did and what he gave to these congressmen who were doing that was the sense that this isn't realpolitik. This isn't maybe a necessary compromise that we can debate about, but this is a holy mission. This is God's work when you are sending guns to someone like Suharto.
Well, as Doug Coe, who's been the leader of the group for decades, says, we see people as flawed, and so we're praying for these world leaders. And the Family did in 1978 secretly help the Carter administration organize a worldwide call to prayer with Begin and Sadat. In 2001, the Family brought together the warring leaders of Congo and Rwanda for a secret meeting. But you write these are benign acts, exceptions to the rule, implying there are more malignant forces at work. We want to hear more about what you think those are. But first of all, just a little bit more about how this works, because a secret society in Washington, how do people even know that there is something called the Cedars, a mansion that you lived in, or that there's C Street? Do they just, you know, rub shoulders with somebody who gives a password or something? How does it work?
No, it's much more casual. What the founder of Verrady and Co., the current leader, have referred to as the man-to-man method. And while there's a few women in the group, man-to-man is key there. In this casual way, that if you're in the right circles, then you'll meet someone and you can be invited in this very kind of soft sell evangelism. It's not a hard sell. It's not, have you met Christ? It's, why don't you come and pray with us? And you start there, and the Senator Jim Inhofe, who current senator, describes it, began with that, and today he is a missionary for the group around the world.
Well, and here's where Peter Boyer, writing in The New Yorker, paints a less dark picture than you do of the family. He says, yes, this kind of private, faith-based diplomacy that the family carries out invites darker interpretations like yours. But then Boyer goes on to say that because family member Bob Hunter from the Carter administration was able to form a prayer group with lawmakers in Uganda, he was therefore in the position to talk them out of that hateful anti-homosexual bill they passed.
I actually just spoke to David Bahati, the member of parliament who introduced the anti-homosexuality bill. And we should clarify that this bill provides the death penalty for homosexuality, 7 years for the promotion of homosexuality. This conversation you and I are having now, 3 years for knowing a homosexual and not turning them in. David Bahati, who I spent a lot of time with, is emphatic that nobody ever asked him to back down the bill. Now, Bob Hunter, I know, is opposed to the bill, but that representation that this was some sort of crusade that the organization took is, according to Bahati, according to many government officials there, they say it's not true. They say they've been encouraged. Bahati even says he's continuing to be encouraged by a couple U.S. congressmen who claim that they can't speak out more publicly because the gays control the media. This is sort of the conspiracy theory thinking they have over there. And the fact is the bill is still very much in play.
Well, and let's underscore this even more. You mentioned David Bahati. You went to Uganda. He's the member of parliament behind the bill and a member of the offshoot of the family in Uganda.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting story. I think Hunter is this guy who went with the best of intentions in 1986. And over the years, they created this sort of apparatus. And Bahati, David Bahati, this young member of parliament, a real rising star in the system over there, comes over to the United States to study in Arlington with a conservative think tank. He meets the family. He starts attending the National Prayer Breakfast. And when I asked him, is there a connection between the fellowship and your bill? He says, I don't understand what you mean by connection. The bill is the fellowship. That's what we do in our group in parliament in Kampala. The group that's being visited by Senator Inhofe, John Ashcroft has visited, Rick Warren has visited. None of those guys are responsible for the bill. And the distinction I think is important. The family likes to say, hey, we didn't kill anyone in Uganda. And it's true. They didn't pull the trigger. But in effect, they built the gun. They built the institution that Bahati has weaponized and turned into this weapon. And even now, they are reassuring Bahati that he is still a member in good standing and that he is welcome in their councils.
That's Dartmouth College professor Jeff Charlotte. We're talking about the secretive Christian group, the Fellowship. No official members, but a formal foundation, a 501c3 called the International Foundation, which oversees 300 or so ministries. The Washington Post recently called it the political enclave that dare not speak its name after it was revealed that lawmakers at the group's C Street house, sort of a dorm in Washington, had several affairs. Well, when we come back, what does the head of the fellowship mean when he holds up Mao and Hitler as examples to follow? Also, later today, testimony expected to resume later this week in that grisly home invasion trial in Connecticut. We'll have that story as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the family, the secretive Christian fellowship that has long cultivated ties with U.S. political leaders, carrying out private diplomacy using powerful American lawmakers, which our guest says is illegal for a U.S. lawmaker to do as a private person. Jeff Charlotte's new book is C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. And Jeff, as we were saying, Doug Coe has headed this group for years, and he talks about Hitler and Mao. How so?
It's a fetish for strength. His defenders say he's just using Hitler's metaphor, and he uses it all the time. You know, this comes up again and again in the archives going back 30 years. He's telling people to study Hitler, to study what a few guys in the back of a Bavarian beer hall who committed to one another totally could do together. Or Mao, he'll say. He said Mao had even had the kids killing their parents, but it wasn't murder, you see, because it was for building the new nation, the new kingdom. That's actually his language. This idea that the best way to understand Christ is not through any of the great Christian traditions of a lamb, or if you want something more aggressive, a lion, but through a strong man, through what he calls a total covenant, of Christ. That's going to lead you into these relationships with strong men overseas.
But do you get any sense that one of the reasons that he's doing that is to change them?
If he's doing it to change them, he's doing a terrible, terrible job. So I think one defense is that there's a certain naivete. And if that's the case, it's time to get out of the business. You know, if after 40 years you haven't figured out that Sani Abacha in Nigeria is another man whom they befriended, and Senator Inhofe on behalf of the family fought sanctions on Abacha's regime. Even when I've gone to family members and said about this, is, well, if we were to hold them accountable, we would lose access. But when you've got guys like former Congressman Mark Siljander, who's a leader in the group, is coming up with some of the theology they're using and is praying with the leader of Sudan, who's currently indicted for genocide. That's not a casual term in his case, and is calling him a friend. I think the phrase he used, actually, in Sudan, referring to the massacres in Darfur, was things got a little out of hand.
Al Gore is a friend of the fellowship. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is a friend of the family.
One of the things you have to remember about this group, first of all, and by the leader's own admission, it's about 80% conservative, 10% people who aren't really particularly political. And then there is a small group of liberals who find something good in it. And that's always been the case going back from the beginning. That's one of the ways that this movement has endured, whereas these Christian right movements that align themselves with a political party kind of fade when that faction of the party fades. You have to ask yourself, how deep is their involvement? When Hillary Clinton was presented with videotape of Coe talking about how a good political model for people is Hitler, Goebbels, and Himmler, her representatives quickly backpedaled and said, hey, we didn't know about that. That's, you know, that's not something we want to be associated with.
What does this story mean to you now in this particular climate?
It's interesting. One of the stories I tell in the new book is about Senator Tom Coburn, who lives in the C Street house and was involved in apparently arranging the payoffs for Senator Ensign's mistress. But the more interesting story is when you started looking at Senator Coburn's travel records and discovering that he is traveling fairly frequently to Lebanon, where he's meeting with Muslim legislators and saying, here I come to you as a U.S. senator, and what I want you to do is get to know Jesus. And if you want to have a relationship with me, you've got to know Jesus. And working with another journalist, Kira Feldman, we spoke to a number of these Muslim legislators, and some of them were horrified. You know, Lebanon is a tinderbox of tension between Muslims and Christians. This is not the place to be doing that. This is presented as somehow ecumenical, because what they're doing is they're sort of saying, we're the third way. On the one hand, there's the people who are too liberal. On the other hand, there's these guys like Terry Jones, who the Quran-burning pastor, who are so intolerant. What we do is we say Muslims are welcome to worship Jesus with us. They emphasize this again and again. And so we have Muslim followers of Jesus, Jewish followers of Jesus. There's a word for that. It's called Christian. And there's a lot of great, honest Christian groups, conservative, liberal, who are transparent about that and say, look, I want to share my faith. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the similarities and the differences. One of the interesting things grown out of the whole C Street scandal is you have a lot of resistance growing in some segments of fundamentalist America. Some of the best investigative journalism has been coming from a hard right magazine called World. That's a very fundamentalist magazine. They don't think Hitler is a good metaphor for Jesus. They don't think that secret clubs for congressmen is a good Christian witness.
Well, so there's been that reaction. But what else has happened to C Street, especially after the media glare?
Well, yeah, you know, that was a sort of the amazing thing. I was pretty certain that it would shut down. I was sort of wondering what kind of congressman was going to move to Washington and tell his wife, hey, I'm going to move into that house, you know, with the three guys who with the mistresses and they're covering up. And then it just got worse. Congressional wife named Ann Ryan, very conservative, came out and said this is a group for separating men from their families. And it's a sort of an anti-woman group. And yet C Street just keeps chugging along as this kind of fundamentalist frat house. But they're getting challenged now. There's a group in Ohio called Clergy Voice, an interdenominational group of Christian pastors who are offended by C Street's tax exemption as a church. It performs almost none of the functions that the IRS designates as a church. And yet here they are getting subsidized housing for congressmen.
Well, we should say D.C. officials did revise some of the tax status and did take away some of the exemptions. And some of the people quickly packed their bags and moved out. And we understand that the conversation inside the organization is about maybe having more transparency, even launching a website.
Even launching a website, I'd say that's a good step. It's a very, very small step when you have an organization that has been secretive this long. And by its own admission, has this real problem, this tension, as one leader of the group put it to me, between accountability and access. We don't want to risk our access to the powerful by holding them accountable. They need to really throw the doors open. And then, look, if this group is transparent, I don't really think we have any concerns. I think the critique of them is not a left or a right critique. The critique is one of transparency. And I will defend much of the Christian right. They go and fight for their issues. C Street goes in a back room and works for its issues that way. A website is a first step, but you've got a long way to go before you achieve transparency.
Jeff Charlotte, his new book is C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. He's also a professor at Dartmouth. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
A district in southern Afghanistan that's been the scene of some of the bloodiest fighting by British troops for the past 4 years is now a U.S. military responsibility. British forces arrived in Helmand Province's Sangin district in 2006 and have suffered heavy losses there in fierce fighting with Taliban insurgents. Now the Brits are pulling out, handing over the territory to the Americans. The BBC's Ian Pannell was in Sangin before the handover. His report begins with a reading of the names of soldiers who've died there.
Captain David Patton, Sergeant Paul Bartlett, Lance Corporal Jabron Hashmi.
There have been some really bad days, especially when one of our lads got killed. It was hard not to give up.
Corporal Brian Budd.
When we go back to UK, there will undoubtedly be a moment of reflection, that moment when we collectively grieve our losses.
Lance Bombardier Leah McLaughlin.
You kind of block it out until we're home and safe. Then I'll start mourning.
British troops have been fighting for 5 summers in Helmand. 337 of them have lost their lives. Incredibly, nearly a third died here, in what's been the most dangerous area of all, Sangin.
A realistic threat out there today, so just make sure you keep scanning the shops as we go through them.
We joined British and US Marines as they prepared for one of their last joint patrols, a time to reflect and for some hard questions about the sacrifices that have been made. Lieutenant Colonel Paul James has commanded the 40 Commando Royal Marines Battle Group in Sangin for the last 6 months.
Well, I won't say, is it worth the loss of life? Because, of course, the loss of life is always extremely traumatic. But I'll certainly say it's never been in vain. It's not in vain. And I think myself as a commander and the boys recognise that. We've actually progressed in Sangin and set it on the right course. We recognise that the job's not done. There's still a long way to go. But actually, it's certainly on the right course.
Well, we're out on patrol at the moment with the Marines from 40 Commando, together with the US Royal Marines, the people who have now assumed responsibility for security in this area. And it's a very surreal, very Helmand kind of scene. Over to my left is a dry, dusty riverbed, and there's a herd of some 30 to 40 long-haired woolly goats and sheep being taken through, together with cattle and donkeys. And over to the right, you can hear the sound of a gun battle that is raging between the US Marines and the Taliban. This is just 800 metres away from where we're walking in the district centre, right next to the base. There was a long and brutal fight throughout much of the day. It used to be like this all the time in Sangin. Now the battles are less frequent, but it shows the Taliban are still here and battling coalition troops. And it'll be up to the Americans to try and finish the job that Britain started.
Set up for six, set up for six.
More than 10 soldiers and civilians were wounded in fighting throughout the day. No British troops were injured this time, but they know what days like this are like. Sergeant Andy Hughes is one of the medics.
I find it very difficult to talk about without having someone have been there. Can't describe the smells, the sights. There's no amount of words I can describe all this. Even pictures don't seem to work. They have to actually be there and get put through the emotions to have a true understanding of what the people here go through.
After so much blood and money has been spent in Sangin, the thought of leaving with so much work left to do is hard to take for some, like Marine James Kelly.
The amount of effort, time, lives lost, I do feel a little bit hollow that we didn't break this place, we didn't bring it to our way of thinking. I feel a little bit heartbroken that we didn't finish it. However, I'm 100% sure the Yanks will, and that is always a good thing.
So Britain's mission in this troubled part of Helmand is coming to an end. It's cost the lives of 106 men. The debate over the sacrifice and whether the gains have been sufficient will continue long after the Marines have left Sangin. And elsewhere in Helmand, Britain's fight continues in a war that still shows few signs of easing.
Marine Jonathan Crooks, Sapper Mark Anthony Smith, Marine Adam Brown, Sapper Darren Foster.
That report from the BBC's Ian Pannell in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Well, when we come back, there's a delay in that murder trial that's gripping Connecticut and beyond. That story in 30 seconds here and now. Testimony is expected to resume later this week in that home invasion murder trial in Connecticut. The headlines from 2007 were stunning. Intruders entered an unlocked basement door to the home of Dr. William Pettit in Cheshire, Connecticut, beat him with a baseball bat, tied him up, tied his two daughters to their beds, raping the youngest, and forced his wife, Jennifer Hawk Pettit, to go to the bank and withdraw $15,000. Last week, jurors in the case heard this recorded 911 call from the bank teller.
We have a lady who is in our bank right now who says that her husband and children are being held at their house. The people are in a car outside the bank. She is getting $15,000 to bring out to them that if the police are told, they will kill the children and the husband.
47-year-old Stephen Hayes has sat emotionless through the testimony. He and another alleged accomplice, who will be tried next year, face the death penalty for killing Mrs. Hawk Pettit when she returned from the bank, and also accused of killing the girls who died of smoke inhalation when the home was set on fire. Dr. Pettit escaped. Jurors were riveted by his testimony last week. But the case is off to a bumpy start this week. The judge was hospitalized last night. Randall Beach has been covering the story for the New Haven Register. Randy, first of all, what more do we know about the judge?
Well, the judge, we're told, was feeling lightheaded and was brought to the New Haven Hospital and apparently is doing well now. We're hearing he's probably been upgraded to good condition, and we expect to probably be out of the hospital and able to resume on Wednesday, though you never know for sure. This trial seems to have been jinxed from the start, where you have a defendant who attempted suicide during jury selection, and we had several jurors and backups and alternates drop out last week under duress. They said they couldn't go forward. Yeah. So we're now down to just 12 regular jurors and three alternates for a long trial.
And by the way, that defendant, Stephen Hayes, in addition to attempting suicide, he had a seizure last week. So, and one wonders, you know, how people are sitting through this. It's an incredibly, as we said, grisly story. Take us back. We'll just briefly go through it. It was an alleged chance encounter in the grocery store that brought the accused in contact with the Pettits?
Yes, the two men, allegedly Stephen Hayes, who's now on trial, Joshua Komarczewski, due to go on trial next year, allegedly observed Jennifer Hawk Pettit and her two daughters shopping at a local Stop and Shop near their home, and followed them back to their home surreptitiously, and they decided at that point they would come back early the next morning and attack.
Well, and it was a horrific attack. The father had fallen asleep on the couch watching television. He was beaten up and, as we said, tied up. But explain, who went to the bank with the mother?
Stephen Hayes, having allegedly discovered a bank book in the house while allegedly ransacking the drawers, saw a lot of money in an account and said, well, maybe this is what we should do. Let's one of us force Jennifer Hawk Pettit down to the nearby bank, which, by the way, was right by that Stop and Shop, and force her to withdraw $15,000.
Well, and there are so many questions, but here's one. So the suspect allegedly returns to the house with the mom and the money. Meanwhile, the father crawls to a neighbor's house and alerts the police. One wonders, between the 911 call from the bank and the police being alerted by a neighbor, why couldn't the police get into the house soon enough to stop it from being set on fire and killing the daughters?
Well, a lot of people are wondering that, because the call, the 911 call, was logged at 9:21 a.m., and the house didn't erupt in flames till approximately 9:55. That's more than half an hour. One of the police department captains in Cheshire got on the stand and said, we were setting up a perimeter. We had no information whatsoever that any violence was happening inside the house. We were following protocol for hostage situations. But in retrospect, it is so frustrating to hear this and to think, if only.
Well, there are other questions as well. We understand the two men accused were on parole the night of the murders. Now, they were petty burglars. They met in a halfway house. And some are saying that none of their prior offenses involved violence. But still, what are the questions now being asked about parole?
The questions are, should there be more safeguards? Should it be harder for someone to get out on parole? And for a while, there was a clamping down after these arrests. It was much harder for people to get out and get on parole. So the whole system, is being examined in terms of who gets out and why and under what circumstances.
Mm. Randall Beach, again, you're covering this trial for the New Haven Register. We just can't help but wonder how difficult that is. We're understanding that Dr. Pettit has been remarkably composed while testifying. People saw video of his wife, Jennifer Hawk Pettit, at the bank, seemed remarkably collected as well. But also during the trial, there were photographs of the burned bodies of these two daughters
and their mother.
How are people reacting to this trial?
Well, Dr. Pettit and his family are being very strong and dignified, and it's amazing how strong she was in that videotape. It's very difficult for all of us as reporters. A lot of us have kids. I have two daughters. It's very difficult to cover this trial for us, to be in the courtroom. We, as reporters, got a chance to see the photos of the victims. These are images you will never forget, never get out of your mind. Jennifer Hawk Pettit's sister said, "These are images we really wish would go away, and they won't go away." And I think as reporters were feeling the same thing, having seen this.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the defendant, Stephen Hayes, his public defender's arguing he didn't intend to commit murder, that he only intended to rob the family. He could face the death penalty if convicted. Well, the amount of vitriol aimed at him in reader comments online is it's overwhelming. But on the other hand, we understand there's some concern that jurors might feel sorry for him.
Ever since they saw those photos of the victims, I don't think that they're going to be feeling sorry for him. Not at this point. Well, the defense hasn't put on its case yet.
Randall Beach, a reporter for the New Haven Register, who's been covering the trial that's come to be known as the Pettit family trial. Of course, it was the Pettit family, three members that were killed. And I'm just wondering, Randall, how is this reverberating in Connecticut? And even reading about it, you want to lock your doors. How is this affecting people there?
It affected all of us in terms of security, alarm systems. I know even my house, we changed our security. And it's all been reawakened 3 years later by the trial starting, with people now having trouble sleeping, worrying about their security, worrying about their families and their safety.
Well, Randall, thank you for talking to us about it.
You're very welcome.
Welcome back. And goodbye to Kathy, that is. Kathy is retiring. What? No more chocolate? No more frantically trying on bathing suits in dressing rooms? We're, of course, referring to Kathy Geiswhite, the woman behind the 34-year-old comic strip Kathy, which first appeared on November 22, 1976, and runs in about 700 papers. We've watched Kathy struggle with her job, food, dating, food, her parents, food. Well, Kathy is married now to Irving. Her parents have moved in with them, and apparently, end of story. On Sunday, October 3rd, the strip will end, and Kathy Geiswhite joins us from Studio City Sound in Studio City, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you wrote in an online chat back in 2002 that you would never retire as long as swimwear manufacturers keep making the suits they do. So can we conclude that your retirement is a thank you to the Land's End catalog?
No. That only increased the material, because my experience with catalog shopping, when you go on to try on suits in a dressing room, you have to take in about 40 to find one.
Right.
So with the catalog now, you have to buy 40 and have them sent to your home.
That's
and
true.
Try them on and then return them. So it's actually worse.
That's true. And, you have to get the half of one and the half of the other. Well, many of your fans know how your cartoon character was born. We know you were sending your cartoons to your mom in the 1970s, and your mom brilliantly told you to take them to a publisher. You got the fastest contract in history. So we know that part of the story. But tell us more about the feelings that you were having at the time that gave birth to this character.
I graduated from college in 1972 at just the peak of the women's movement, and I graduated literally with a copy of Ms. Magazine in one hand and a Brides Magazine in the other hand. I was such a product of exactly both generations, mm-hmm. you know, raised by Ozzie and Harriet, and I went from Ozzie and Harriet to Gloria and Betty Friedan, you know, Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan. And I really gained 50 pounds of confusion in college by just nothing was right. You know, the old way wasn't right. The new way wasn't right. And when I graduated, I got a job in advertising, and I started experiencing the full glory of the new liberated woman. And I was not experiencing the old glory of having a relationship and, you know, getting married and starting a family. And I continued eating after college. And there was a lot to be angst-ridden about. And those were the first drawings I did, was just kind of summing up my frustration with all of it.
Well, and obviously it resonated with so many women. I mean, you were doing in cartoons what wasn't yet being talked about, eating issues, self-esteem issues. So it seems like a wonderful gift, an outlet for some women. But what do you say to the people who, again, at that time, this is when women were trying to be taken seriously, and some people were critical of you? They don't want to see a woman obsess over her weight. They want her to bring Middle East peace, which
right.
doesn't make for a good cartoon.
Well, bring Middle East peace and be comfortable with her beautiful, natural body shape and size, right? Well, first of all, I don't think that the people who criticized the strip really read that many of the strips. They might have read one or two where she was, you know, surrendering to a donut, but they didn't read the ones that were great triumphs to me in Kathy's ability to get up and retry every day. And when I started the strip, literally men and women were having the conversation about, should a woman be allowed to get a job, or should a woman be allowed to pay? And when you look back, you go, well, that was ridiculous to even be discussing. But at the time, they weren't easy answers.
Well, the very first panel, I've got it in front of me. It's Kathy with her long hair and bell bottoms.
Bell bottom.
1976, right? And the bubble, the thought bubble above her head. She's talking to herself, Kathy, he's hurt you too many times. Next time he calls, just bite your tongue and give him your answer. Next panel, phone rings. And then the third panel, she answers the phone and says,
yes. Yes, with her tongue between her teeth. Okay, so that wasn't exactly a liberated statement.
Well,
that's a woman being vulnerable, you know, endorsing a wrong relationship. And I would feel terrible about the fact that the strip launched that way, were it not for the fact that I now have an 18-year-old daughter. And, you know, pretty much my daughter and all of her friends, the same moment could be written for them right now.
Well, I was going to say, it's an illustration of how far you've come, because you were that single woman for decades, and now you are married and have children. But I would also say, you know, on the other end of that phone is maybe a guy quaking, too. There's no, I mean, what's the big deal, you know, if she's waiting for a phone call?
I love writing about the little moments that nobody talks about, you know, the bad moments on the other end of the phone. I'm somebody who has to pretty much have full makeup on before I would even listen to my voice messages when I was single, you know. I had many days where I had to call in sick because I was too large to get into any of my Dress for Success outfits. You know, those are things you could never admit to somebody, but women have not solved our thing with food, and we haven't solved our self-esteem issues. And those are the ones where, to me, women need to at least know that somebody else has been in the same spot.
Quick question. You've been acknowledging your many female fans. What do you hear from men, and do you have any thoughts about your impact of the strip on them?
I've gotten great feedback from men over the years, and I certainly don't mean to exclude them when I'm talking about my connection with women. It's just that I partly a little bit love that I've created something that men couldn't ever completely understand the same way that women do. But many, many men have written to say that reading the strip helped them understand their girlfriend or mother or wife, that it wasn't unusual for a woman to have more than 9 pairs of virtually identical black shoes and claim that they all had a completely different purpose, for instance. The fact that a woman never orders dessert but then always eats most of his dessert, that's pretty much a global thing, not just his own girlfriend or
Did he see some kind
wife.
Of problem with that?
Yeah, what? Exactly.
Well, with all of the success and satisfaction you just described, why are you stopping?
This is a year of huge birthdays. My daughter's turning 18 and starting her last year of high school. And I just turned 60 last weekend.
Congratulations.
My parents are hitting big birthdays this year, and they live really far away from me. And I feel like suddenly all these personal deadlines are way more pressing to me than the newspaper ones. And I want to be, for 1 year of my daughter's life, and you can imagine how thrilled she is with this concept, I want to get to be the suffocating, doting, overbearing 24/7 mother that I haven't been able to be when I had a deadline all the time.
Wait a minute. You want to be that fussy, overbearing, doting, suffocating mother that you describe in the column. Kathy's mother.
Yeah. The last few years here, I've gone, wow, am I writing about mom or am I writing about me? I'm suddenly finding way less fault with the mother in the comic strip.
Well, Kathy Geiswhite, what's the last panel? You probably can't tell us what the last panel is, or what do you want to get across?
It's so overwhelming to me to be leaving this job. I can barely even express it, and now I'll start weeping right here on the radio. And I feel like the luckiest person on earth that I've been able to do this for a living. Not to mention the personal therapy, the millions I've saved on therapy by being able to do this for a living. It's too much to squash into one comic strip. But my feeling leaving is one of just profound gratitude and profound love for the women, especially the women readers who have stayed with me all these years and who have covered such complicated, emotional, funny, and not so funny turf with me all these years.
Kathy Geiswhite, the creator of Kathy, the comic strip, speaking to us from Studio City Sound in Studio City, California. After 34 years, her final strip will appear on Sunday, October 3rd. Kathy, thank you, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and